Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Insider Trading and Sufficiency of the Evidence Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 6, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Salmon v. United States. Bassem Yaqub Salmon was convicted in a jury trial of conspiracy to commit securities fraud, as well as several counts of actual securities fraud. The government's theory was that Salmon, whose brother-in-law Munir Kara worked for Citigroup, had coordinated with Munir in an insider trading scheme that, over the course of just a few years, grew a $396,000 brokerage account controlled by Salmon into one worth more than $2 million. Salmon moved for a new trial, arguing that there was no evidence he knew that the tipper had disclosed confidential information in exchange for a personal benefit. The district court denied the motion. Salmon made a similar argument to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit on appeal, urging the court to adopt the then-recently established standard set out by the Second Circuit in United States v. Newman. Under Newman, the government must present sufficient evidence that the accused knew the inside information he received had been disclosed in breach of fiduciary duty. Invoking Supreme Court precedent in Dirks v. SEC, the Ninth Circuit rejected Salmon's challenge, holding that the close familial relationship between Salmon and the Caras was sufficient to sustain Salmon's convictions. The question before the Supreme Court was whether the personal benefit to the insider that is necessary to establish insider trading under Dirks requires proof of an exchange that is objective, consequential, and represents at least a potential gain of a pecuniary or similarly valuable nature, as the Ninth Circuit held in Newman, or whether it is enough that the insider and the tippy shared a close familial relationship, as the Ninth Circuit held here. By a vote of 8-0, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, a unanimous court held that the Ninth Circuit properly applied the court's decision in Dirks v. Securities and Exchange Commission to affirm Bassem Salmon's conviction because, under Dirks, the jury could infer that Salmon's tipper personally benefited from making a gift of confidential information to a trading relative. To discuss the case, we have Thea Brooke-Knight, who is Associate Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Knight.
Salmon v. U.S. is the first insider trading case the Supreme Court has taken in nearly 20 years. This means that the court could have chosen to provide much-needed guidance in this notoriously murky area of law. Fortunately, the court instead chose to issue a very narrow opinion that, while clarifying one outstanding question, still fails to provide any meaningful information about its views on this crime in general. So, to summarize the facts briefly, the case involves three men who are all related to one another. The insider is Maher Kara, who worked in Citigroup's healthcare division. He passed information to his brother Michael, who then traded on the information and also passed this information along to their brother-in-law, Salmon. The question before the court was whether a person can be guilty of insider trading if the insider received nothing in return for providing the information. At the trial court level, it was determined that Maher had passed information to Michael for three different reasons. First, he disclosed information to Michael to get Michael's help in understanding some scientific concepts because Michael has a degree in chemistry. Second, he disclosed information to Michael related to cancer treatment when they were trying to evaluate options for their dying father. And third, he disclosed information to Michael as a favor. Michael called and asked Maher for help. Maher offered him money, but Michael said that he would prefer information. Maher then gave him material non-public information, understanding that Michael would trade on it. Even though Maher called him back at once and begged him not to trade, Michael did trade. And when Salmon received information from Michael, he was aware that it had originally come from Maher. So the question in this case revolves around this chain of events where neither Salmon nor Michael gave anything in exchange for the information that they received from Maher. In an earlier case, Dirks v. SEC, the Supreme Court held that insider trading occurs only when the insider obtains something of value from the person to whom the information is provided. In insider trading terms, this is the tippy, the person who is not an insider but receives some information or a tip from the insider. In Dirks, the court found that Dirks was not guilty of insider trading because his intent in passing along the information was not to obtain profits for himself, but to undercover a fraud at the underlying company. So again, in Salmon, Maher received nothing from either Michael or Salmon in exchange for the information. But Dirks does include language that is arguably dicta, but that says that insider trading may occur when the insider gives information to the tippy as a gift. And relying heavily on Dirks, the court in Salmon found that if an insider gives information to as a gift and the tippy trades on it, insider trading has occurred. So in this case, they found that Salmon was in fact guilty of insider trading because he received information that had come from Maher, that he knew was from Maher, and that Maher had given to Michael as a gift. So while this decision clarifies this one question left open to Dirks, which is whether an insider may give information as a gift, the decision as a whole is very terse. It's only about 13 pages. And it doesn't include any statements about the policy concerns behind either this gift exchange or insider trading law generally, including, most importantly, why insider trading law should exist, why insider trading should be illegal. And, well, there's sort of this emotional reaction to insider trading where people feel like, well, you know, somehow it's just unfair that somebody is getting this information. This is just something that people shouldn't be doing. There's actually a lot of debate in the academic literature about whether insider trading should be illegal. And insider trading is unlike a lot of other federal crimes because there's no actual statute that explicitly outlaws this kind of activity that says that insider trading specifically is illegal. Instead, what's happened is the courts have interpreted a very broad provision in the federal securities laws to include a proscription on what has come to be known as insider trading. This broad provision is Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And this provision prohibits the use of, quote, any manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance, end quote, in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. It also grants the SEC the authority to establish rules and regulations to implement this provision. And the SEC, in response, promulgated Rule 10b-5. And Rule 10b-5 doesn't really add a lot of detail. It's still a very broad catch-all provision, says that, you know, you can't use fraud or deceptive practices in trading securities. It's so broad, in fact, that almost all securities cases include some sort of 10b-5 allegation because it just sort of applies to any bad act in relation to securities, given its breadth. But neither 10b-5 or Section 10b of the 34 Act actually mention insider trading. So overall, making policy and making legislative choices, creating, defining crimes, is the prerogative of the legislature, and setting policy is prerogative of the executive. This is just not within the judiciary's purview. But at this point, we have several decades of insider trading law created by the courts. And while it might be great if we repealed this and asked Congress to actually pass a law if they wanted to prohibit insider trading, at this point, we're stuck with this. And so if the courts are going to create a crime, they should take responsibility for what they're creating. And part of that is making sure that it's easy for people to understand the crime and easy for them to understand what behavior is illegal so that they can avoid it. And unfortunately, insider trading law has always just been a little bit squishy and a little bit undefined. And I think to understand where the squishiness comes from, we have to understand what the arguments are on both sides for making insider trading illegal and for making it illegal. So the argument against criminalizing insider trading, the argument in favor of allowing this kind of trading to occur, and I want to be clear that I'm just talking from a legal standpoint. In most cases, corporations have agreements with their employees that govern their use of inside information. That is entirely private contractual law. What I'm talking about is what we do with federal criminal law. So the argument for allowing insider trading under criminal law is that the securities markets depend on a constant flow of accurate information. The more good information there is coming into the markets, the more accurate the prices and the better the market quality. So, for example, if a big drug company like Pfizer knows that one of its major drugs is about to be pulled from the market and plans to announce, let's say, first thing Thursday, anybody trading at the end of the day, first thing Friday, anybody trading at the end of the day Thursday is trading on bad information. Up until that announcement is made, from between the time that it's clear that this drug is going to get pulled until the announcement is actually made and that information is incorporated into the price is inflated. So it's better for the markets for this information to get out there as quickly as possible so that the price can adjust to the true value, which has to do with the value of the underlying company. In this case, we're saying, for example, Pfizer or whatever the drug company is. So if an insider knows about this information and trades on it, that starts to add the information into the markets as quickly as possible because, you know, there are a few ways that information gets into the markets. One way is a company making an announcement, and then everybody uses that information and changes what their bid and ask is in the market. Another way is that people just start using different, people just start trading based on different information. So if you have a bunch of people shorting a company or dumping their stock in it, that is going to drive down the price. And the reason for that is that the market understands that there's something about the company that is worth less than people thought that it was, that there's some sort of information out there that people are using in their trading. And so it's very important to get as much good information out there as possible. And that's the argument for permitting insider trading, that we want to maximize market quality, we want to maximize price discovery, and in order to do that, we need to not damn any kind of flow of information. We need to let that flow freely into the markets. The arguments against insider trading to say that it should be illegal, one has to do with a sense of fairness about the markets, that it's not fair for some people to have access to this information that other people don't have. But the thing is, that doesn't really square with how the court has ruled in prior cases. So one of the very important cases in insider trading law is Chiarella. And in Chiarella, there was a trader who had information, and it was non-public material information, and he traded on that. But because he wasn't a company insider, the court found that he had not committed insider trading. So that means that if you don't actually get the information through some sort of chain with the insider, it's perfectly legal to trade on it. So for example, you overhear information in an elevator, a cab driver overhears a conversation in his cab, it's perfectly legal to trade on that information. There's no direct sort of confidential relationship or trust between, in that case, the cabbie and the people in the back of his cab. If we were really just concerned about making sure that there's a level playing field in terms of access to information, Chiarella would have come out the other way. We would have had a decision that said, no, look, it's just not fair for people to trade on non-public information. You must first disclose before you trade. But that's not what we have. So we have this other theory of insider trading liability, which is the misappropriation theory. And that says that this insider trading is deceptive and should be unlawful because the insider is making inappropriate use of company information, and therefore this is like theft. But the thing about that argument that makes it a little bit squishy is that we don't punish every misuse of inside information, only misuse that's related to trading. So for example, in Salmon, if we look at this second disclosure in which Maher was disclosing information to Michael in order to discuss options for their father's treatment, clearly, there was no corporate purpose there. This was a purely personal use of the information. And we might say it's a very sympathetic use of the information that the two men were trying to help their father. But yet, if this is theft, if use of the information for personal reasons is theft, this must count, and yet it doesn't. So, you know, if you take an example of theft, if Maher went and broke into a CVS and stole drugs for his father, we would say, while we're sympathetic to his situation, this is still theft. And yet in insider trading, we don't say that. And in fact, in Salmon, the court hinted, although did not explicitly say, that this disclosure of information for the purposes of their father's treatment did not trigger insider trading liability even though Michael subsequently traded on that information. It was not clear from the record whether Maher was aware that Michael was going to go trade on that information, but there is this sense from both at oral argument and later in the decision that this disclosure, because it was not for the purposes of trading, does not trigger liability. And it makes sense that insider trading must be related to trading, but if the problem is that this is a kind of theft of information and therefore theft of company information should be criminally punished, we should criminally punish all theft of company information, including disclosures for other personal purposes. And we don't do that. So ultimately, there may be a good argument for outlawing insider trading, and it may have something to do with this fairness in the market, and it may have something to do with the company's interest in its own information. But the court so far has not really clearly articulated this justification. And as a result, there's a lot of logical inconsistencies among the different arguments for making insider trading illegal. And the problem that this presents is that without a unifying theory of liability, it's really difficult for individuals to determine what behavior might be illegal. So if you understand what harm it is you're trying to prevent, it's much easier for you to take a hypothetical situation and say, oh yes, that should trigger liability. We don't have that in this situation. It also, without this sort of understanding of why we have the law, it makes it difficult to justify its existence. We say that something should be criminalized because we can identify the harm that it causes. In this case, it's very difficult to identify exactly what the harm is that insider trading causes, and therefore it's difficult to justify making it a felony. The fact that the law is judge-made also means we have no congressional record. While congressional record is obviously not controlling, these records can be illuminating in that they can help to understand what the harm was that the law was trying to prevent. And with insider trading, we have to rely exclusively on case law for this kind of insight. And with Solomon, we do have a little bit more information on sort of a rules-based standard of what constitutes insider trading. If you give a gift to someone of information that constitutes insider trading, we're no closer to understanding the theory behind insider trading law as a whole.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.